RG6U. It's a basically nice roll that I picked up at Home Depot for about $40 for about 500 feet of it. And basically I just used that because it's white and matches the color of the house on the outside. So there's nothing really magic going on there, but it is a very low-wattage cable, the RG6U. And as far as being close to the water, I do have canals within about three blocks either side of my house. And I'm roughly about half of a mile to the bay. So I'm not exactly on the water, but still not very, very far from it. As far as antenna polarization, I've tried to do polarization experiments, you know, trying to see if it's a vertical or horizontal antenna. But it seems to be predominantly vertical for some reason. There again, I've asked some questions on that, trying to find, make some sense of it, and I'm really not quite sure yet.
Yeah, when you did your polarization measurement, if I did it by talking to a guy in Philadelphia, we'll say, at least one ionospheric bounce has occurred because you're way beyond ground range, and once the signal has been through the ionosphere on 80 meters, it can easily be twisted three times due to Faraday rotation. So therefore, a polarization measurement in Philadelphia would be very difficult to interpret. The signal getting to Philadelphia is going off your antenna at a very high angle, and the only way I could measure the polarization at that elevation angle would be to fly a helicopter near your antenna, and I think you haven't done that. So if somebody had a three houses away, had a 100-foot high tower, and you made measurements at various altitudes of the tower, a polarimetry, it would be a fun thing to do. I think the best you can do to measure polarization is to go a block away with some kind of a sensing device, a field strength meter, and try it horizontal and vertical, and try it at various altitudes if you have some way of elevating the sensing antenna. So I am guessing your polarization tests were with people beyond your ground range, and therefore, because of what the ionosphere does, it's kind of difficult to interpret. That's a guess on my part. Go ahead and fill me in on that one, Glenn.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate, Dick. I've also done some of the near-field measurements, everything from standing in the backyard right in the middle of it to going a few blocks away to a few miles away. And it seems that any time I'm in vertical polarization to it, or mobile especially, I seem to pick up the best. Also, I find that anybody that's on, like, inverted Ds and vertical antennas that are on that band, I have very, very strong signals with going all the way up to New Hampshire, Vermont, and as far south as going down to Florida. Don't have much of a problem making communication there. I seem to have more of a problem east and west. Like, there's a big gap, like Ohio stations, other things like that. We tend to be a little bit in the mud, but then occasionally, certain times of night, bang, all of a sudden California comes in. Normally at around, I would say, anywhere from about 8:30, 9 o'clock till maybe, you know, 2, 3 in the morning. For me to contact Europe, England, you know, most anywhere on 75, the lower end, and usually in advanced and extra sections. It's not all that difficult making contact there. But usually, when I ask the question, you know, which antennas are they receiving the best on, it's usually mostly in the vertical polarization where I get usually the strongest signal reports from.
Yeah, when you did your polarization measurements by walking around the neighborhood, I wonder if the polarization was different, whether you were, let's assume now that your feed point was at the northern end of the circle, and if I measured the polarization north, or when I go off to the east, or I go off to the south, I make a different polarization. So my first question is, where are you feeding it? Are you feeding it at 12 o'clock, if 12 o'clock is dead north, and 6 o'clock would be dead south? Is that the feed point? When you get that not-so-good performance through Ohio, it could be because there's a null in the pattern toward Ohio, or it could be that the state of the ionosphere is such that Ohio creates a polarization rotation that is cross-polarized. Maybe the guy in Ohio was using a horizontal antenna and you're feeding him a vertical signal. So is Ohio down in the mud because of pattern, because of which angle, which end of the circle you're feeding, or is it because of cross polarization? That's question number two, I guess. When it comes to good performance north-south, do you sense any skip zone? When you're talking to Florida, can you also talk to Virginia, as well as Maryland? So there's a whole series of questions in there. So start off with where are you feeding it, Glenn? Go ahead.
My feed point is a little bit strange. Basically, what's happening is where it's being fed is from the second story of the house, and it kind of does droop down at a slight taper from, let's say, the second story down to roughly the first pole of the picket fence in each corner, and then it basically follows all the way around the property, and that would be the westernmost side of the house. The feed point would be from the west. And it does have a slight slope down on that side until it reaches the first leg of the picket fence, and then it follows that, you know, 4.5 to 5 feet around the whole yard when it comes back up against the feed point. And as far as generally having dead spots locally here in the States, north and south, like zero dead points. I can usually pick up anybody here on Long Island. When people say they generally can't hear the other stations on 7580 News, I can always usually hear them. You know, here on the island, although there are some spots like going, when I start going west where I start to see dead spots, like sometimes somebody in New Jersey will be on, and that's where I'll start, you know, I'll have more difficulty hearing them as opposed to somebody in Connecticut. But then again, once it gets to like Ohio, over the pool, it pops up again right about there.
Yeah, your feed line is thoroughly shielded. RG6, by the way, particularly if it was RG6/SAT, is a foam-filled 75-ohm cable, rather low in loss. As long as you do a good job of weatherproofing the end of it so water doesn't crawl up there, that could be working like a charm. But since your feed line is thoroughly shielded, the fact that it droops, in my opinion, is of very minor consequence, because I think your feed line is doing very little of the radiation. You've got a symmetric antenna being fed in a symmetric manner with a symmetric feed line. So I think there's very little opportunity for common mode current flowing on your feed line, out of conductor, and therefore how it droops doesn't matter. Whether you run it underground, above ground, come in at a drooping angle, right angle, purely vertical, I don't think it matters. That's a guess on my part. Let's see what Mel thinks of this. Hey, Mel, you went through all the rigmarole of putting your full-wave loop 80-meter antenna 40 feet in the air. Glenn did it 6 feet in the air. And he's getting significant performance. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, mine's 45 feet here, approximately on fourth support. And it works, I'll say, excellent, really. I get good, no blank spots from here outward. Well, let's see. The furthest that joins us, we have a group that gets together on 75 meters. Three nights a week, and if Glenn would like to join us, 11:30 at night usually, we get on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 3.820, and you'd like to kind of give a comparison with your loop versus my loop, or some of the other guys with loops, how they hear you and whatnot, be glad to hear you join us. And my loop, I honestly would say, I talk to my friends in up north, Massachusetts, Maine, down through New Hampshire, Pennsylvania. There's a couple of guys that join us from Virginia, one from Florida, and I get excellent copy on them all. That's basically what that antenna was, basically what I wanted out of it. And outwards, the furthest outwards people that join us are usually out towards western Ohio, towards west Virginia. And once in a while, there's one or two guys that do join us from Texas. However, we've had in cases, we've had people that join us from California. In fact, the discussion, that's the next thing I got here, the discussion got around to antennas. And I got a nice email from one of the guys here, Dick, that I'll cover next. Over.
One last question there, Mel. It seems like Glenn is periodically working Europe. Have you heard Europe on your outdoor loop antenna?
Yeah, I'm not particularly looking to be, you know, a DXer on the 75-meter band, even though I've worked just about all the DX that come through. Every so often the group all of a sudden says, yes, we're hearing coming through. Let's go take a look. So the whole gang goes down to 3.7 95, the DX window. And sure enough, there is the sub-DX station out of Europe, and we all join in. And I'm amazed that the loop seems to be an excellent performer, as good as any of the other guys with the antennas and all, except for my friend Woody. Of course, he's king of the castle, Woody. He sits on the DX window. He tuned the beam. He's got a three-element beam on 75 meters that's tuned for approximately around that frequency, and he just works DX one after another with that. In fact, some of them really don't hear that well, and he claims he's getting 5.9 copy on all of them, but I mean, that's the extreme already. Three elements on 80 meters, on 75 meters at 187 feet, Dick, but for the rest of us, I will say the loop is as good as anything else that these guys are coming on frequency with, over.
Where's Woody located? What's his call letters? Boy, does he have an antenna.
Okay, you want to take a look at it. WW1WW. He's in New Hampshire. Yeah, New Hampshire. What he did, what he's quite a fellow. He used to get on all the time, and he says, wait till you see what I'm going to do. Wait till you see. And this went on for a number of years. Finally, he did it. He bought a hilltop 600 feet up on top, bought a nice chunk of property up there, a number of acres. And got a home up there. He put, I don't know if he built a home or bought it, this property or however. And that's where he installed this 187-foot tower and stuck this three-element beam to the 80-meter beam at the top of the tower. And then he's got a whole bunch of them. Different beams all the way down the thing, but that's the top stack, and you can take a look at his website there. He's got a picture of that tower. It's unbelievable, Dick.
Okay, I'm going to put my little picture to shame. Amazing. So Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 3820 kilohertz is where you guys meet, and did I hear you say you meet at roughly 11:30 at night?
Yeah, they're all mostly retired gentlemen, so, you know, they stay up to the wee hours of the morning. And let me tell you, a lot of times we're up to the wee hours of the morning. These discussions that we're having get hot and heavy. It goes on and on and on. Usually I call it quits sometimes around 2 because my eyes are closing. But I'll give you, for instance, what happened next, I mean, on the next one when we're finished with this, Dick.
Amazing. My last question, though, is when you get into this group on 3820, and this is most likely the group that you described, your inside the shack fraction of a wavelength loop antenna. Have any of those guys accepted what you've seen, or are they all giving you skeptical remarks there, Mel? Go ahead.
The inside loop, I basically use that when we have the high noise level. Because the noise level here, once in a while, gets outrageous. Otherwise, I can get away, for the most part, with the outside loop, both transmitting and receiving. But occasionally, with high noise levels, in fact, the problem is that with that receiving loop, you know, if you're in a group like that, you got to keep swinging it around, and all I miss a lot. By the time I get the antenna phased onto this one, and then another one comes on, the guy is from Maryland, and then we get the guy in Massachusetts, and it's in Pennsylvania. I got to keep swinging this thing around the receiving loop, so, you know, it becomes a problem. But when we get some real nasty conditions, and I will say, you know, we'll take it step by step, see if we can make, you know, some communication. So usually if I get on, like my friend George WD3FRY over there, in North DeSales, PA, that's outside of Pittsburgh, I will just set it for him so I can get some communications from him directly, because he's basically a friend of mine. But it's a problem. You got to tilt the end, you know, to get that loop, that receiving loop. You know, I got to tilt it, I got to turn it, I got to adjust the variable, I got to adjust the noise washer, set the second loop on the noise source. You know, it's a one-to-one, from one place to another. When left, it's great, but going to jump around one place to another, Dick. It's a problem to use it, over.
Mel, you've got to consider automating that. When you find the ideal tuning for each one of those guys, and you put it into the program as a reception number one, reception number two, and then as you go around the round table, you press the right button, the machine automatically steers itself. Look what fun you could be having.
This is K2KTY. Now, the problem is, here's really where that experimentation with this thing has surprised me. It varies. One night, I got the loop standing perfectly vertical, and let's say I'm talking to my friend George in PA, and he's coming in great. Another night, he's weak as all heck, and I says, what the heck? I tilt the thing, and there it is, peek it up. The Faraday rotation, of course, is doing all kinds of manipulation to the signal. So there's no set way of really setting this thing. It could be from one night to another, completely different angles and twisting and turning of this thing, Dick. There's no way to say, oh, I know tonight I'm going to talk to so-and-so, and I know I'm going to be able to set it this way because prepared for experience. It don't exist that, Dick, over.
Okay. You and I are accepting the fact that the ionosphere is quite dynamic from day to day and maybe even hour to hour. And you know that when you join this group, you're going to go around the round table 6 times or 10 times. On the very first loop of the round table, you find the ideal tuning for each one of those guys that particular night. And you tell the system to remember it. Then for each of the round tables that night, you've got it set. Have you ever seen a significant change in the proper setting during the round tables of one particular night? Back to you, Mel.
I have. Every night this happens. We get on at, say, around 11:30. For some reason, there must be some switches thrown somewhere up there in the atmosphere that around midnight, around quarter after 12, everything changes. It lengthens out. This is the only way. That's when all these DXs, the guys will say, hear that noise level in the background coming up? Yeah, that hits in the back. Yeah. The band is most likely open, and usually that's correct. It seems, well, if we look at it this way, that in Europe, the daylight is 5 hours approximately different. So around midnight, it's around 5 o'clock in the morning, it's still night. In other words, we're catching that gray line exactly right. And it seems like that when 75 or 80 meters really comes into its own between midnight and about 2 o'clock in the morning. Then as the sun, I guess, begins to, you know, rise over there in Europe, the daylight in Europe is most likely, you know, really showing illumination of the sky or whatever, like it would be here at 5, 6 in the morning. That's when the band starts to disappear, Dick, over.
If you took data from day to day, hour to hour, and plotted it, compare it to the gray line for various seasons. Boy, that would be one heck of a data set you could do all kinds of operations with. I guarantee there's hidden information there. You need a hobby. I know you want to go on to the next one, and you've got another piece of information you want to give us. Go right ahead, Mel.
DC2QIQ with one more comment.
And another question.
Glenn, and then the other question. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, one of the things that always confused me, and I'm not sure if it's propagation or whether it's just, you know, the hours that people wake up and they go to sleep, is that a lot of times, like, if I'm talking to my friend Fred or Steve, G0AOJ and M17DK, you know, in the United Kingdom, I'll pick them up somewhere around 9 o'clock, but it's really 3 o'clock in the morning over there, and I know that they probably don't sleep very much, you know, Fred and Steve, and my friend Peter over in Poland, ST9QMT. You know, he'll be on, like, I'll catch him somewhere between 9 and 10 p.m. But, you know, yeah, it's true. As I start getting around 12 o'clock, it starts getting a lot more busy with people in Europe getting on. But is that maybe just because they're getting up at 6 o'clock a.m.? I don't know.
Let's see what
Mel's going
to say about that one.
Hey, this is K2KEY. All right. No, usually they're also the guys that we know in Europe, a couple of G station guy in Ireland, I can't think of their calls, she's spoken to them so many times, They usually say to us that the signals, they agree that the signals peak up around what hour midnight, and usually over there, say at Greenwich Meridian time, GMT time, of course they're around 5 o'clock, 5 hours difference. So they seem to also confirm that somewhere around what we would say is midnight seems to be when it starts to really peak up at not, they know to get up. They're real DXs, Vic. I don't know if I still, after all these years, can drag myself out of bed at those ridiculous hours just to work some DX anymore, over.
Understand. Who is the other person who had a question or a comment?
Good evening, Vic. WW2WW. Just a question for Mello. Just curious, the size of his loop that he's using for 80, did he use the standard measurements on that? And did he pick the height of 45, or is that just something that worked out for his towers or supports?
I'll bet you it's 270 feet, 45 was... Mello, go ahead and answer that question.
As the loop has been shown a number of times in articles, USB and ham radio, 272 feet fed open wire feeders. It's just one continuous wire with four supports. It's not exactly 65 and so feet on a, you know, it's longer because my house, my way to property is I have like 45 in the front and 45 in the back, and then the other two are the two longer lengths. But it doesn't seem to have any really effect on it. Our wire actually is a number 12 wire. Onto the shack from the, I use a Johnson kilowatt matchbox. I'm not using any Valum. I use link coupling from the Johnson kilowatt matchbox through the feet, through the wall, the porcelain feet through that I mentioned, made out of, from the use of, that they use an oil burner system, those electrodes. They go through the wall, goes up to the support where there's an insulator, and goes around the four supports, comes back to that insulator, and uses homebrew 6-inch spaces made out of a piece of plexiglass, goes right back down to another one of those feed-throughs, back to the Johnson kilowatt matchbox, goes one continuous wire, no soldering anywhere down the line, over.
Wow. Are you thinking of building something like this, Tim?
Yeah, as soon as I find a football field to move to. But it's my dream, man. There's no doubt about it. And the next time you talk to Woody, let him know he's got 368 QSL cards waiting on EQSL, including a country called Svalbard.
Yeah, Woody's a busy fellow. Oh, yeah, when he gets on, he gets pile-ups on him. And have you seen what his antenna looks like? Over.
Yeah, if you do his call sign, WW1WW on QRZ, that's his main picture. It's his main array.
Pretty impressive, yes. Okay, he finally achieved it. He says, wait, you see what I'm going to do. And he did it. Okay, great. Okay, back to you, Dick.
How much property have you got over there in Keensburg, Tim?
I got a 60 by 125, but I am moving. But we're actually thinking of putting up something like this in a temporary location and driving a car out to it.
Yeah, one of the things I've discovered, and I bet you Mel will back me up on this, is that if at all possible, try to make your ham radio location and your residence one and the same. K2UIH on a number of occasions in his past has rented a mountaintop QTH and put a great big dish on there and a tower and all kinds of things. And the frustration he had, and I think it was a 50-mile drive from his house, is that there are times when the band is open and he's home. There are times when he's at the location and the band is not open. You're always in the wrong place, so to speak. So if at all possible to get maximum enjoyment out of the hobby, try to make your ham location and your residence one and the same. Back to you, Tim.
Yep, we've always tried to do that. Unfortunately, it hasn't always been that way. Being in a small, short community, sometimes you're limited. But we always like to have a little special location to go hang out in the summertime and stuff, or even in the wintertime and sit in the warmth. The last time we did that, we ran a big giant football roller coaster tower here in Keensburg, and being close to the water actually works pretty good. So that's just kind of, we were just fooling around with that, but I hope to put that up in a permanent location in the future. But we appreciate that help, and I would love to see some pictures and maybe some schematics, or, well, you basically just, you spelled it out for me and I wrote it all down, so I pretty much got it all. Just was looking for some correspondence, maybe to look at some reference to look at that. All right, thanks very much. Appreciate it. WW2WW, back to that.
There is one classic exception to what I just said. The guys in California have something called the Remote-Based Repeater Association. In other words, quite a few of these guys will set up a really good station on top of a mountain and have all kinds of radio wireless equipment to communicate with it. And as such, they can have the advantage of being at home and radio-wise be on top of the mountain. So if you think you're good enough with telemetry systems and servo mechanisms, that's another way to go. It's a pretty big investment, though, in all of the control and communication to it. But, boy, that would be fun. The guys in California on mountaintops are doing it all the time. I don't know of anybody who has a remote base set up on the East Coast. Do you, Tim?
Now that in 10-meter repeaters, that's about it. Nobody has that, I know.
Okay, back to you, Mel. And I can read another one if you like.
The number of them are on that using that internet system for, you know, radio, controlling the radio and everything over the internet through a remote transmitter. So there is a number of these stations that are on. And, yeah, like I say, it's just no end to, you know, what you can do. What's nice about the loop, the final words on it, it's basically invisible. You know, if you don't point it out, you didn't look, you know, you see the poles and all, but if you don't look closely, you don't see nothing really, because that wire, that black wire especially that I use, becomes almost invisible against the sky. So it just looks like poles standing there. If I stuck get flags on it, they would think it's just plain flagpoles. So it's, I can say, almost self-camouflaging, these type of antennas. Okay, let me go on, I guess, Dick. Hold on a minute. Okay, oh, yes. Okay, no, it's late, but I'll hit upon this. As I said, this discussion has gone on at 75 meters quite a number of times. And one of the responses I got, oh boy, this was from the Southern California DX Club. And they have gotten together, and they did a lot of research, and you know, the discussion again, of course, I get the question many times, quads versus gadgets. And they have done a number of experiments, and in fact, they said here that all their experiments were conducted under the auspices of Dr. Jim Lindsay. Yeah, Dr. Jim Lindsay, who covered the subject of parasitic end fire arrays and circular loop elements, etc., quads and Yagi, for the IEEE. And I wonder if you know Dr. Lindsay, Dick, experiment with antennas over.
I don't think I do. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, supposedly he did quite a bit of experimentation and wrote a number of articles on it, but here's basically what they summarized, a number of things here. They got lazy things about quads and all, and he summarizes, you know, we were talking about 20 meters and all, he says, and they went band for band, basically, and they said all their experiments were done basically on quad, designed by Dr. Lindsay, and no, quad designed by Dr. Landskov, L-A-N-D-S-K-O-V design. Are you familiar with either one of these gentlemen, Dick, over?
I would say I'm not, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay, I guess they did quite a bit of antenna experimentation and all, and he goes band for band, the results, you know, everything right up to UHF, what they did, these guys. And he just basically summarizes here. It goes into a lot of details, but I'll summarize here. On the bottom of each, on 20 meters, A two-element quad is a disappointing antenna. It will not be as favorable as a two-element trapped tri-bander, which we use as a comparison, which basically is a two-element trapped tri-bander that is on a 2-meter or 6-foot boom. That was our reference. And they go on and on here and telling us all about the experiments were all done towards the beginning here. The article is quite lengthy. All our experiments were done at Pepperdine University, Malibu, California, under the direction of Wayne N6NB, N6 Norway Bravo. Do you know that gentleman? Over.
Wayne Overbeck, very well. He and I were in the same antenna gain competition once in New Jersey, and I gave him a heavy amount of competition on his quad Yagi antenna, which was the rage at the time. Wayne's done some pretty nice work at Pepperdine. Good man. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, so there it is. There's the story, basically, and they said that they found that in their particular measurement, where the heck was it? Oh, we were talking about height. That 21.3 meters needs to handle the HF frequency that we tested the quad at Yagi. And it found that, that, believe it or not, a quad really comes into its own. It was at low height as suggested. It's not true. Okay. On all three bands that especially checked, we tested the quad, exhibited a excess of 20 dB, while the tri-band never exceeded 14 dB front to back. And, oh, I don't know, they go into a whole different year of charts and things. And we did not ever saw that the quad was never superior to a tri-band in any of the front-to-back ratio tests. And so on. So I got so much information here. I don't know. I'm just glancing over it. But it seems that they favor Yagis over quads. I mean, basically, if I want to go by test results of each band, Dick, over.
I think you'll remember that Wayne Overbeck, Dr. Wayne Overbeck, is the guy who had the article in Ham Radio Magazine a whole bunch of years ago, where he took a trailer with a crank-up tower on it, and he drove roughly a fraction of a mile from each of these main DXers to TH and made measurements of signal strength and tried to compare quads to Yagis. And I vaguely remember the difference was rather small, and I think he's saying this probably represents later work than that ham radio article that Wayne Overbeck was involved in, and he's coming to the conclusion that the people who have this strong belief that quad is a super antenna is somewhat unconfirmed. Is that what you're getting out of this, Mel? Go ahead.
In fact, I give an example here. He made a measurement. He said he went, that's exactly what he did. He's got a picture, in fact, he sent me of that truck with that crank-up tower on it, and he went to this one particular location, and he made a measurement, and he says the best measured gain of all the antennas that he looked at, and this included 4- and 5-element quads versus 4- and 5-element monobanders. The KLM monobander that I tested had the highest gain on 20 meters and beat any of the quads. He did say in final that he believes that the Yagi is the ideal antenna overall, and as far as he says also the best in all possibility, even over saltwater, I found that the Yagi performed as good or better than any quad. Oh, I don't know. That's the experiment they did. I guess they seem to, one of the experiments also was using a design known as the MASHIN, M-A-T-H-I-N, long boom quad. They did not deliver the gain that they should have, that according to the mathematics done by Mashin and Landsdorf. I don't ever heard of this Mashin, M-A-C-H-I-N, long boom quad. Maybe you're familiar with it, Dick, over.
Nope, I'm not, sorry to say. Now, it appears from what you said so far that one of the main criteria Wayne Overbeck and company were looking for is front-to-back ratio. And if you're a California dude aiming your antenna toward Japan, we'll say, because you want some DX, or Australia, and you want some DX, and you got the whole damn United States in your back lobe, I can see in that environment where front-to-back ratio, and therefore the QRM area you're going to get, is rather important. So I guess they use that as one of the major criteria. Also, when it comes to overall forward gain, probably is their secondary criteria. A real Yagi has elements that have some number of inches in diameter, whereas a cubical quad usually has wider as those quad elements, which is much, much smaller in diameter. I am curious as to whether or not either the resistivity or the number of wavelengths of diameter is a factor in what we're seeing here. There's a darn many people who believe a quad is going to have a lot more capture area and a lot more performance per dollar. Let me drop. Whereas I think you're saying that these set of measurements seem to be saying Yagi has got it all. Roughly how recent were these measurements, if you can tell from that data? And with all of this mailed to you at your email address now, K2KEY, K2LIW.
And I got a manuscript here. I didn't get this is a thing that they copied. Oh, my God. There's a lot of pages here, Dick. I'm just running through it quickly. They got band by band and high and low quad, main low, whole discussion on main low testing, front to back ratio, another testing. And finally, what do they got here? I just went basically to summation and conclusion about antennas, and here they came to one of the conclusions is that high-frequency cubical quad out there somewhere will deliver to you 2 dB more forward gain than a well-designed Yagi we have not seen. Okay. And then they went on here that a claim was made, one of the Yagis, that they four-element quad that were delivered to us by somebody there, I don't know whoever this is, at 666NA, said that he claimed a 12 dB gain on his four-element quad, and this did not show. It was more like 10 dB gain on his quad. So, and they have a whole... I'm telling you, you can spend the whole night just really looking at all this information here and references to this guy, Wayne Overbeck, the long boom quaggy, which you mentioned, and people like Dr. Lance Lindsay, Dr. Belcher is another one that works on it, Dr. Lawson. I don't even know who a lot of these people are, but they sure have a lot of references to their work that was combined with this extensive study. Because they do mention about 10 people were involved in it, Dick, over.
Yeah, Lawson is a name that I recognize. He's written a whole lot of Yagi articles that appeared as a great big long series in Ham Radio Magazine. And he's published individual self-published books. What was the mechanism by which you received this mail? They mailed to you this manual, and is it because you are Q-selling some of these guys in California, or is it because somebody knows them and knows about the TechNet, or you've been discovering it, discussing it? So what was the connection by which the Wayne Overbeck report, I'm just going to give it that name, what was the mechanism by which someone decided you should have a copy? Because of our discussions on the TechNet, go ahead.
Now, I had discussed this with one of the people that belongs to the Southern California DX Association. He had joined us one or two times. trying to prove that on 75 meters that he could easily, how he reaches the east coast with his 75 meter antenna, which is basically, he's got, I think, six elements, but they're fixed. I think I mentioned this to you, that what he does, he put together this delta loop and beam effect, and he actually is a piece of rope that he pulls up with these elements, and he manipulates this thing around, and he, when he wants to work, I guess, for Europeans, he was looking for his DXCC plus on 80 meters, so he just pulls this thing around and you know, fakes it out, and he, I think he winds up like 6 or 8 elements on 80 meters fixed. It's fixed, you know, it's all wire, but he wants to prove and what he, the sound, how sound the system is, and he was telling us all about it. Of course, I mentioned things that we discussed, so he was sent me all this information on work that the Southern California DX Club has done, especially for low band DX, over.
Good group. Good group of serious guys who just love HF. Wayne's also a VHFer because his original quad Yagi, Quaggy, was on 432. And on the beachfront, on the flat sand, he set up an antenna range and did a whole lot of testing and measuring to come up with that Quaggy. For the guys in California, a wooden boom light Yagi antenna, where you live in the Mojave Desert, is fairly appropriate. A wooden boom Yagi on the East Coast, where we get quite a bit of rain, is not such a great antenna. And for those who have tried to simply take his wooden boom design and substitute a metal boom, sometimes the results were a little bit disappointing. I don't know whether or not Wayne has ever supplied information as to how to readjust the element lens once you use a metal boom instead of a wooden boom. Also, he was doing that work a little bit before I really came out with the insulated elements. So even if the elements do go through a metal boom, I'm not sure whether or not Wayne has a design where he's insulating the elements in the metal boom. Just simply putting the elements of a more than 4 or 5 element Yagi, putting the elements through the boom, is not completely the solution, because as you build up aluminum oxide and it breaks contact, the elements tune themselves to a lower frequency, and that could be bad. Okay, it looks like you've got some nice reading for a cold winter night. K2KUY, K2LAW.
Roger, well, I built the, I have the 432, I think I showed it to you, I have the 432 Quaggy that I used on field day, and the wooden boom, and it works quite well. We've used it a number of years on for field day. I can say it's not the ideal antenna for me to have outside here for 432 with that wood one. I don't know if it would stand up that long no matter what you do with it. So, but I keep it in the garage and drag it out once a year, bring it down to our field day, and that's part of the our VHF, UHF back array for field day. All right, well, let's see. Oh boy, I got so much stuff here, Dick. I don't know what really to... want to try to jam one more in?
Go for it. Go for one more.
Okay, Roger, this is K2KDY. All right. Here's another question similar to this. Here we go again. Yeah, about, have you ever seen the kit that they are selling from one of these wire antennas? What is this? Called a folded end fire radiator, similar to the WHJK type of design, and it's a more modern version of the WHJK. Well, you know, basically, remember the WHJK made with 300 ohm television twin lead. Now, what the heck is this one made of? It's made out of like a wire, stiff wire something with a stiff wires. I don't know if you ever heard of this antenna called the folded end fire radiator, Dick, over.
I'm certainly familiar with the WHAK, which is really two dipoles approximately a half wavelength apart with a crisscross feed between them. It's an all-driven antenna. And I'm not sure now if the twin lead is put in the middle of the crisscross center between the two Yagis, between the two dipoles. Now, this N-folded thing, do you have a picture of it? Roughly, how does it differ from your point of view, Mel, from a WHAK?
Okay, from what he sketched out here, what does it look like? It looks like two rectangles set next to each other with that cross-phasing line in the middle, similar to an HAK, except it basically looks like two rectangular loops sitting right next to each other, Dick. Now, let's see if he gives me some kind of information here on. Let me read this over. A 6-meter model used 20 feet. Oh, I see. He's using it for 6 meters. A 6-meter model uses 20 feet of wire arranged in a 2-by-4-foot rectangle with center sections of transposed line spacing about 3/4 of an inch. With a small loop slotted across an opening at the center of one side and resonates at 50 megahertz. That's the one he's mentioning. This is for the 6-meter model, Dick, over.
It sounds like each of the radiating elements is a skeleton slot loop, is what I would call it. There was a kind of a Yagi antenna where you've got two Yagis vertically displaced, but one common driven element, which is a skeleton slot between the two. This sounds like a skeleton slot without the rest of the Yagi element. A pair of skeleton slots. Is that what you would call it? In other words, it's a like a pair of cubical quads, except the quads are not square, they're rectangles. Would that be close to what you're saying, Mel? Go ahead.
I guess you could describe it that way. There is one flat plane. I'm looking basically at the sketch of it, and that's what it is. It looks like a WHAK, except that the ends are, if you were to shorten it down and just fold it back. So in other words, to make a complete loop out of each element and use the same phasing method in the middle there as WHAK uses. Let's see, feeding the W8 at the center crossover point using 2 feeders open wire matching transformer. Then it says, I don't know, it says it's being sold as a excellent 6-meter antenna that takes up very little space because it only requires a 2x4 rectangle. And it's being marketed by N6WE, Washington, state of Washington, or something like that. I guess he sells it as some kind of a kit, Dick, for 6 feet over.
N6 Whiskey Delta. I'm going to Google that right now and see if I can see a picture of it. Back to you.
Okay. I guess that's the person who has got the design or the patent on it. Yeah, I guess it's interesting to look at. Let's see. Does he even make one for the lower frequency bands? In fact, open wire line, they've actually made one for 40 meters. Boy, oh boy. It's an interesting concept of putting it together. Required for 40 meters, 136 feet of wire. With 68 feet of open wire line to the house. Okay, and he has one here and shows for 10 meters, another one for 20 meters, and so on and so forth. And for example, could be put slightly above your roof, will work excellent in a small space, and especially for people with a situation where they can't put a full-size two-element beam for 20 meters. This seems to fit the situation excellently. That's what the comments are, Dick. Over.
As I Google November 6 Whiskey Delta, I get a bunch of aircraft information. As I Google N6WD 6 meters, I get nothing. N6WD antennas, antenna, I haven't gotten anything. Do I have to call letters correct? November 6 Whiskey Delta?
November 7, number 7 from state of Washington. Number 7, no, 10-7, Norway 7, Whiskey Delta, over.
That's the difference. I'll be right back to you. Go ahead.
Hey, so that's the antenna, basically. If I see a picture, I mean a sketch of it, it's two horizontal quad elements, and spacing, very close spacing. And, for instance, on a 40-meter band, the elements are spaced only 3 inches apart. And still will work excellent, and of course, because of its compact size, that it will fit into a small property. Especially, this is excellent idea can be also, I guess, extended for use on 80 meters. But especially for 6 meters, 10 meters, 50, 20 meters, this seems to be a good compromise antenna that is easily installed on a small property. That's what it's basically advertising as, Dick, over.
Okay, so it's called N7 Whiskey Delta, and what is the name of the antenna itself? If I use those words, maybe I'm going to find it.
Called a folded end fire radiator. A folded end fire radiator. Based on the design of a WH. I guess based on the design of WHJK. That's what it's got here. It's based on the design of a WH. But the only WH that I know of that has anything similar to that is WHJK, John Krause over, my old buddy.
Okay, I found a ham radio index with that, but I haven't found the article itself. And I'm still searching. Maybe I'm going to find it.
Hey, sounds like it. I'll tell you something. It just never ends. I think everybody coming up with, with the antenna design, I would assume that you take a piece of wire and do some bending and twisting on it, you may just come up with who knows what. Like you say, there's no end to how many times or ways you can twist the dipole over.
As I've often said, Mel, there's only 5,000 kinds of antennas, and new ones are being invented all the time. I'm involved lately with quite a few patents on UHF antennas for RFID purposes. So we're coming up with new ones quite frequently, and just last week we think we came up with a new one with a significant performance. So, N-Fire, what was it again now? I use here November 7 Whiskey Delta folded N-Fire radiator, and all I got was indexes to Ham Radio Magazine that mention a somewhat similar sounding article. So you've seen a picture of it. Somebody's got a website with a picture where I can actually see the thing in 3D, if you know what I mean. We've got to find one of those. I'd like to see it. And we've got a couple of minutes before we got to start closing down. Back to you, Mel. K2LAW.
WB2EAV.
Hi, you roughly. Go ahead and tell us where I can find it, Ed.
I'm afraid I can't help with that. All I called in to tell you is I now am talking to you on antenna number 5001.
Fantastic. Going to file a patent?
No, it's just a vertical dipole using surplus 12-gauge house wiring.
You used to make some really genius things out of coat hangers. Have you stopped using coat hanger wire?
Yeah, I would have used coat hangers, but I couldn't have hung the coat.
Understand. That household copper wire, was it 14 gauge?
Good heavens, no, 12.
Oh, you're going you're going Cadillac. Have you ever considered 10?
No, that was in the old house that I did a project with the tin gauge wiring. Oh, and that was stranded. No good.
So you're using 12 gauge solid. Beautiful. Mel, back to you.
Okay, repeater in a couple of minutes, so I'll just wind this up here. We had an April Fool's joke at one meeting where a guy came in and he says, "You said you could make this beam, a dipole beam, small little compact thing, for 2 meters out of coat hangers." And I said, "Yes." He says, "Well, I made it out of coat hangers, and it don't work at all. I can't get out any place with it." So I said, "See, I can't imagine why it doesn't work." "Nothing," he says, "it's worthless." So he brings it in. Dick, you know what he made it out of? I bet you can.
If it wasn't coat hangers and if it wasn't household wiring, I'm at a loss. Go ahead.
Don't tell me you used wood or plastic.
You get this for God's sake. He made it out of plastic coat hangers, Vic. Over.
Okay. Are plastic coat hangers conductive or an insulator?
I don't think they're very conductive. He says, "Well, you said make it out of coat hangers. You didn't specify that they had to be wire coat hangers." So he would pull my leg because, he glued it together and all out of plastic coat hangers, he had it outside, and he said, "Should I bring it in and show you, and you tell me what's wrong with it?" Of course, when I saw that, very serious about it, he says, "Well, you didn't specify wire coat hangers, Dick," which I didn't, over.
No, I've really used coat hanger antennas.
Yeah, wire coat hangers, not plastic ones. Is that true, Ed?
Yes, steel wire coat hangers. And the reason I used it is because it's the world's only 100% theft-proof antenna, because nobody else wants it.
Understand. Well done. Okay, we got about a minute to go. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1177 of the series that began in February 1982. 25 and a half years, roughly. If all goes well, Mel and Dick will be back next week and carry on a little bit further. 73, you all, be kind to each other. Mel, you got it.
Hey, very good, Dick. This is KTKUR. Yeah, that's a good joke, Make up one of the antennas, one of the guys that suggests, and ask him, "Can I make it out of coat hangers?" And he'll say, "Of course." And you make it out of plastic coat hangers, and then pull its leg and say, "You told me I make it out of coat hangers that this antenna will work up on UHF," and tell them that it don't work at all and all, and say, show it to them. And when he looks at it, you'll see his face, of course, will turn to a grin or a frown, and say, "Well, you didn't specify wire coat hangers," and you can have a lot of fun with it. With somebody, especially, that's in the antenna business. I thought of doing the same thing. Okay, with that, 73 is all. We'll try to do it again next week. So we'll try to answer the emails and try to keep it simple. I know they get complicated. And take care, everybody. Have a great week. This is KTKUY. Good night, all.
Ed, do you go to work tomorrow?
Yes, why?
I didn't think you ever... I thought you'd start getting your beauty sleep at around 9 p.m.
No. It's just that I got an HD for the first time in years, so I can listen to you from the house instead of from the car.
Fantastic. Glad to hear from you. Hope we'll hear from you next week. Bye-bye for now.
Another great net, and I still say, if this is what you consider slowing down with your thinking, we'll take it. WB2EAB.
See what a pay testimonial will get you? The check's in the mail, Ed.